Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by Julie Lando Shahan and Rachel Hoffer. They are the volunteer co-chairs of Violins of Hope. Welcome.
Hi.
Violins of Hope is a fascinating project, and I want to learn more about its history, about what's happening now. Rachel, why don't you start us off? Tell us, what is the basic idea here? What is Violins of Hope all about?
Violins of Hope is essentially a collection of over 70 violins that have been played during the Holocaust. Around 20 plus years ago, a gentleman out of Tel Aviv by the name of Amnon Weinstein and his son Avshalom decided to take these violins that were played in the Holocaust and restore them and put them into playing condition. And so over the last 20 years, he actually went on a radio show, much like this, and he had a plea for people who had a connection with the Holocaust, who had these violins that were played there, to bring them to him and let him restore them. And then over the last, 10 plus years, they've gone throughout the world, and they are now played in various concerts, there's exhibitions, and a host of other events throughout the world.
So there's a lot of richness in what you just said that I want to unpack a little bit to make sure that the significance of this really gets through. So we're talking about a period of time in European and world history, the mid-20th century, horrific wars taking place. People in Europe, Jews are being rounded up along with others and put into camps. There's a massive amount of disruption and tragedy and awfulness happening. And in the midst of all this, there are violins. We're talking about musical instruments from that time period that have been preserved?
Absolutely. And they're preserved in different ways. Some of them have been buried and are found after the Holocaust. Many of them are actually played in some of the concentration camps. And some of them even came to Israel before the Holocaust began in the 30s. And when they first arrived in Israel at that time, and they came from Germany, these players actually no longer wanted these instruments from Germany. They wanted nothing to do with them. So they went to Amnon's father, Moshe, and they said to him, basically, either you buy these instruments from us or we destroy them. And so he purchased the instruments to make sure that they lived on, although he never knew what he was going to be doing with them. And they sat in his studio for years and years and years, decades in fact, until Amnon decided that it was time to share these instruments and begin to tell these stories.
So for historical context, the 30s is British mandate in the Eastern Mediterranean. People are immigrating to a land that's essentially being administered by the British. Moshe is what, a businessman? What was his?
He's a violin maker. He was a violin player. And in Europe, he decided he's going to Israel. And what would be a job that would be able to be useful? And there were a number of Jewish musicians. And so he decided that would be a way that he'd be able to find work.
Fascinating. Of course, this is pre-state, so he's not moving to Israel at the time, since Israel becomes an entity in 1948. He comes to this new territory, he settles, he continues to make musical instruments, and then as other people are coming from Europe, they're bringing instruments with them, and he starts to build a collection.
Absolutely.
And that's just a small number or fraction, anyway, of what is now preserved in this collection. A lot of them were discovered or recovered in very different circumstances, having been preserved throughout World War II.
So much so that since they arrived in Phoenix 6 weeks ago, they've added two additional violins to their collection for people that have heard about the program here in Phoenix and now have given those violins to be restored and played.
Phenomenal. Amazing. I want to hear a lot more about the history and the present of this thing. Julie Lando Shahan, how did you hear about this and what was your involvement? How did you first become connected with Violins of Hope?
Well, actually, it was about 3 years ago. We had a women's philanthropy luncheon, which is a group of women from the Jewish Federation of Greater Phoenix. We had an incredible philanthropist as our speaker. Her name is Jane Weitzman. And afterwards, we had the opportunity to have dinner with her and just talking about community and engagement and, you know, interesting things that she might have seen in her travels. And she mentioned to us Violins of Hope, which had just completed a really, really incredibly large exhibition in Cleveland. And she was actually able to send us brochures afterwards and all the information. And when I first looked into Violins of Hope after she told me about it, it was obvious what an incredible program this would be for our community. So I had the opportunity to meet with Rachel and tell her about it, show her some of the materials, and we both just felt that this would be so important for our community, the broad community. And that started our pursuit of the Violins of Hope Phoenix.
So this permanent collection is based out of Tel Aviv, and it travels around the world, currently here in Phoenix. How long has it been here, and what did it take to make that happen?
Well, it took a lot of effort on the part of Rachel and myself. I think, you know, this first was 3 years ago, and it took us about a year to actually get the commitment from the Weinsteins. It was kind of interesting. We were both attending a conference in Washington, and the Weinsteins and some of the violins happened to be there. And this was after a year of emailing and calling. You know, Rachel is doing it, I'm doing it. And finally, we actually were able to pin them down on the spot and get a date. And that date was, you know, February, March, 2019, which actually worked out really well because we needed all that time to prepare all this incredible programming and establish all the partners and the organizations and the funding for the project.
Now, how did you two get connected? How do you know each other? And how did your relationship evolve to the point that you are now the volunteer co-chairs for Violins of Hope Phoenix?
I didn't know Rachel. I knew she and her husband, Jonathan Hoffer, are incredible young leaders in the Jewish community. I asked Rachel, I think, just to, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm remembering this wrong. We went to California Pizza, and I didn't really have an intention of asking her to be involved in this, but just wanted to get to know her and find out what she was interested, what she was involved in. So through that lunch, I told her about this and asked her if she would have any interest to working on it with me. And she said yes right away. She was she was really into it.
Rachel, why was that? What first grabbed you about this project? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of historical significance, a lot of really powerful history and memory and collective experience here. But what drew you to this and had you say yes?
There were, I think, a couple things. One was when Julie had mentioned it, I have a number of friends in Cleveland, and I had already heard about the program through them, although I never really thought that we'd be able to bring it to Arizona, to be completely honest. So that was one thing. So it was already a little bit in my mind. And then in addition to that, I have three children that I'm always trying to expose to history, to what's going on, to our future. And this program just really spoke to me as far as just the vastness of it and that we could do so much with it and touch so many different individuals. And that was certainly very exciting. And then 2 months after I spoke with Julie, and as she mentioned, we were on the phone, emails, trying to get a commitment for quite some time. I was in Israel for my daughter's bat mitzvah, and there happened to have been a Violins of Hope concert in Tel Aviv that I went to, and after hearing the violins played, and as I'm saying this, I'm getting chills right now, after hearing them played, I knew that it had to be something that we brought to Arizona, and so I got back, and really with a renewed kind of energy, we took it to the next level, and just we were calling, talking, and just excited about bringing them here.
It's a wonderful opportunity to connect the dots for people about an aspect of the Jewish community's experience, but also world history, that for so many folks is an abstraction. You know, we often hear accounts of the Jewish experience in Europe being compressed into a couple of sentences. You know, number 6 million people lost their lives, so many people displaced, et cetera, et cetera. And there's literally no way to let in the significance of that at the level of the numbers themselves. What is it about this project that you see works in that regard to connect the experience, the history, the stories with people in the present day?
I think everyone learns differently. And I think that's something that the violins allow for. They allow for being able to see a violin and understand a story. And each of these violins are actually like history books. They each have their own individual story. And so being able to touch the violin, being able to hear the violin, they really touch upon all of our senses. So what might appeal to one person and not the other then will appeal to that next person. And so you're really able to understand it in different ways and have these different connections. Some of these stories include children, and we're telling stories about a 12-year-old boy that had a violin, and the violin was able to take him and really save his life in the Holocaust. And a seventh grade student connects with that story where they might not connect with another story. And so we're really able to address these issues through these stories.
Julie, why is it so important that we keep stories of the Holocaust alive, not just for the Jewish community, but for everyone? There are some who might say, it was a terrible thing, let's put it behind us and move forward. Obviously, that's not the commitment of this project. And yet at the same time, there's a sensitivity and awareness and compassion involved here. So can you unpack this a little bit more?
Sure.
Why do we need to keep telling these stories and learning this history?
Well, there's really several reasons. And as time goes on, as survivors are no longer living to tell their own stories, this history becomes so remote. We're going to be speaking to 23,000 kids. Most of these kids weren't even alive in 9/11. So a history lesson on something that's 70, 75 years ago is very hard for them to relate to. So that's one aspect of it, to continue the stories and the voices to make them relevant on that personal level that Rachel was mentioning. The other thing is, if you look at our world today and look at what's going on around us, in our country, in Europe, in Asia, all over the world, there is a significant rise in hate crimes, a significant rise in anti-Semitism, and a significant rise in hate groups. Even in our own community in Phoenix, in Arizona, the statistics have spiked up dramatically. And if we don't tell the stories, and if we don't make them relatable, and the lessons that we're trying to get across, I'm very afraid that we're going to repeat some of the history. And that's why it's important for the kids to hear it and for adults to be reminded that acceptance, being kind to people, not bullying kids, that these are things that these kids are living with and that we're living with in our world today. And it's really critical that we bring them to mind and connect them with our history so that the genocides that we experienced, and we are experiencing genocides after the Holocaust, that we make an effort to stop them with the future generation.
That's absolutely right. And you know, a number of years ago, I visited the Museum of Tolerance in West Los Angeles, and they have a fascinating presentation where they put the Holocaust in Europe and the Jewish experience in particular in a much broader context of the entire range of intolerant actions and behaviors that humans are capable of. And what it helped me and hopefully everyone who visited that wonderful exhibit to understand is that we're not talking about something that is only out there far away that those people did. We're talking about tendencies that are driven by fear and anger and other of our baser human conditions, which when not checked can lead to horrific things. And, you know, specific examples of Cambodia and Rwanda and Armenia and, you know, many, many other large scale crimes against humanity would be the contemporary language, but, you know, genocidal events in our history. And the message is be vigilant, be mindful. The everyday prejudice is part of that spectrum. And it's important to recognize and deal with the reality of the fact that as human beings on one planet, we share a world and we don't always live like that. We live like those people over there and us over here and all the stuff. For kids, it's especially, this is a really critical message. Can you give us an example of some of the programming that has happened and continues to happen with Violins of Hope? How do the violins actually get used? I know there's a variety of different ways. There's performances and exhibitions and so on, but what actually happens and how does this help open people's eyes to the reality of what you're talking about?
In our education programs, when we're visiting schools, we have a PowerPoint presentation Many of our presenters have personal stories. They're either survivors themselves or children of survivors. And we found that that is very important for the kids to hear. We always bring several violins, and sometimes we bring, there's a viola and a cello as part of the collection as well. So sometimes we have a quartet playing the violins and playing music that the kids can relate to. And, you know, I heard a really interesting story the other day from one of our docents who was taking a group of school kids through our exhibition. We happened to have a, you know, subtle donation box on the wall. And often visitors put money into that donation box to support the program. And there was a seventh grade boy going through the exhibition who asked the docent, "What is that for?" And the docent explained to him that this is a way that people who appreciate the violins and the exhibition, can show their gratitude. So this was at our exhibition of 26 violins that he had just gone through at Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. This young boy took a $5 bill out of his wallet, held it over the slot for like 90 seconds, thinking about if he should put his money in that slot. And after about 90 seconds, he did. And the docent, as she told me the story, was so blown away that obviously that $5 bill meant so much to that seventh grade boy. But yet he wanted to show his gratitude by making a donation. I thought that was an incredible story.
Rachel, what are some of the events or moments in the Violins of Hope's presence here in Phoenix that have stood out for you? What's a significant memory you'll have as they return back to their home in Tel Aviv and continue to travel? What's a memory that you're going to keep from this period of time?
I think the biggest memory beyond seeing the students hear the stories, which has been really impactful for me to be able to be at these sessions, is hearing the music and then hearing people after the concerts and them really understanding. There was one concert in the very beginning, one of our opening concerts, where I believe 21 of the violins were played. And before the concert, I went with Amnon and his wife, Ossie, to give the musicians the violins, something that I'd obviously never been a part of before. And we laid out the violins, and each of the violins essentially have a name, whether they are from a specific area, whether they're honoring a specific person or a group. And each of them, as I had mentioned, has a story. And so the musicians were essentially called up and given their violin. And there was not one musician that received the violin that did not have tears in their eyes as Amnon shared the story with them, because they realized, I don't know if they realized that it was a burden for them to be able to have this, or even more so than a burden, a responsibility. They had a responsibility and an opportunity to be able to allow these violins to be heard again. And so the victims were no longer quiet. Their stories were being told and shared. And I couldn't believe it. And I said something to Amnon's wife, Asiela, and I said, "Wow, this is really moving. I never had expected this." And she said, "The violin is like an extension of these musicians' bodies. And for them to use a different violin than they typically do is a big deal. Never would they just take a violin, even if it is the nicest, most expensive violin, and play it versus their own, because theirs is a part of them. But for them to be able to play these, it was something totally different. And to see their tears and understand it more so, and then know they were going to be affecting thousands upon thousands of people to hear the music come out of the violins was really very meaningful for me.
Music is powerful and emotional anyway, but when you connect the music through the instrument to the story, both of that violin, of the person who had it before, the larger story of the Holocaust, it's got to be an incredible, I hadn't thought of that before, but of course every musician must be feeling such a presence of that unimaginable experience, which is really quite a challenging thing to do. so many of the events in history don't live for us like a present day phenomenon. And yet the violin and the music from the violin forming a very real connection from the past to the present and then also beyond must be incredibly impactful. It takes a lot to pull off a project like this. You, the two of you, as capable as you are, didn't do it alone. Talk a little bit about the kind of support you've received from the community and others throughout this project.
First of all, we have an incredible project manager who really is our third co-chair, Allison Johnston. There's no way we could have done this without Allison. We started like a two-prong approach, and that was first we reached out to organizations in the community that we thought would want to collaborate with us, you know, arts and cultural organizations. And I found the results was fantastic. Just about everyone was like, yes, we want to be involved. Yes, we want to do this. The second prong was to raise the money to bring this project here. And the same thing, we made presentations throughout the community to major funders, major foundations, and we had almost 100% success. It was so gratifying that for me, it really gave me a huge amount of motivation to push through this incredibly huge program.
And I think, as Julie noted earlier, when we were given the date of February, March 2019, I think we both looked at each other and we wanted it much sooner. We couldn't believe we were going to have to wait two additional years in order to start this project. I don't know that we could have done it any earlier. As Julie said, we started collaborating with organizations very early on and getting people on board. And each of these organizations that really have maybe their own goals typically, they set everything aside for this common goal of putting together the most unbelievable program. And I really think that we've been able to achieve our goals and really exceed them. We've been absolutely pleased. And we've also met and become friends with a number of these people in the different organizations over the last 2 years.
You know, we had some objectives when we started developing the program that were important to us. And we really wanted to create a comprehensive program where we weren't duplicating events, where we would have something for everyone, young or old, and that we really wanted people to attend multiple things. So that was one objective. The other thing is we wanted to geographically have accessibility in the events all around the community. And we even went so far as to reach out to Flagstaff, Sedona, and Tucson. We wanted to expose as many people as possible. And with the time constraint that we had of the violins, I really feel good about achieving both of those objectives.
So when did the violins first arrive in Arizona?
They first arrived middle of February, and that really began the violin portion of the program. Although February 3rd, we had the opening at the Cutler Plotkin Jewish Historical Museum for an incredible photography exhibit by Daniel Levin, where he flew to Israel and photographed Amnon's workshop and many of the violins. So we started in early February. The Weinsteins and the violins arrived mid-February, and were going to be with us through March 24th.
And what's next? After the violins leave here, what happens next? And what's the future of this project in Arizona or beyond?
We've had such an incredible reaction. The violins are leaving March 24th, and we are entertaining some future projects that will keep the momentum of the community engagement and the enthusiasm around this subject alive. So there's a couple things we're looking at next. We're just not really sure exactly which program we're going to go with, but we may go with multiple programs. There's a lot of opportunities for the future.
Seems like a lot of infrastructure's kind of been figured out and put in place as these things have traveled from exhibitions to schools, lectures, performances, et cetera. There's a network now of people that you have mobilized and engaged for the duration of this project. Rachel, what are some of your thoughts about the future?
I think something that we've come across that has been really amazing, which Julie mentioned about the collaboration, is that everyone is all in and everyone's doing an unbelievable job in doing this. And also something that we've noticed where I believe the sixth community, is that correct, Julie?
Yeah, probably.
The sixth community in the States that has hosted Violins of Hope. And with each community, the community before us has shared some of their successes, maybe some of their failures in really improving the program. It's really, no one is keeping the information to themselves. And we found a couple weeks ago, we had a dinner with the Weinsteins, and people flew in from Cleveland for the dinner, a couple people from LA, because it will be in LA in 2020. And so they flew in to find out some information, to connect with us, so we could share stories, share our successes, as well as some of the information that we might have to improve the program that they're going to be putting on. And I know that we will be heading out to LA, and we'll be in San Francisco next year to attend some of their events and be a part of it. So while they're leaving Phoenix on the 24th, I think Julie and myself, and certainly Allison, will remain involved with Violins of Hope. And we feel that we also have additional family members with the Weinsteins. We were able to really connect with them. And I know I'm going to Israel in June, and they'll be attending my daughter's bat mitzvah when I'm there. So we've made some lifelong friends.
What lessons have you learned through this process about organizing something of this nature, or about the impact of music and story and the importance of that? What's some top-level lessons you might share that other communities, other folks who have something they would like, let's say, to have more awareness for their experience, for their cause? Is there something transferable out of this, even beyond the stories of the violins, that another community organization might be able to benefit from?
Well, this for me is kind of just a typical lesson. And what I would say is to someone who was attempting a large project or had an idea that they wanted to implement, and when you come across the people that say, you're not going to do it, it's not going to work out, you know, the naysayers that throw all the roadblocks, keep going with your idea. Keep going with your goal. Keep going with what you want to create. And I realized that all the objections that we had, there are solutions. There are ways of making things happen. And it's just a question of coming up with that solution and not getting discouraged by the things that people will throw around you of why it's not going to work, what you want to do. Dream big, and then figure out how to make it happen.
Rachel?
I think get the right people on the team to help make that happen with you, which I think we've been very fortunate to be able to do.
This is a phenomenal experience. Where can people learn more about the project? Obviously, their time here in Arizona is short. By the time someone's listening to this, they may be gone. But the phenomenon is much bigger than just their tour here in the state of Arizona. Where can people go to see some of the online materials and maybe listen to some of the performances? I don't know what's out there, but where does it all live?
Well, our website will remain, Violins of Hope Phoenix, which will chronicle many of the things. Our Facebook page will remain. Out there, you can Google Violins of Hope, and you can see a documentary online. There's like a 59-minute PBS documentary that people can see pretty much about the Cleveland program. And there's just general information out there about it. There's a fabulous book. We had the author here, James Grimes, and his book, Violins of Hope, is a way for people to read four or five more stories and really hear the whole background of the Weinstein family and how this program came about. Anything else you could think of, Rachel?
I think Googling Violins of Hope, you'll get quite a bit of information. And just keep in mind in your travels that they will probably be in a number of different communities in the States over the next, I think they're booked for the next 3 or 4 years. So they'll be here for sure, and it's just going to be growing.
Well, this is a phenomenal thing. The ability of these artifacts, these instruments, to connect the stories of the past, the tragedies, the triumph in the face of terrible circumstances. with the present day through music, through visual experience, et cetera, is really phenomenal. I just want to thank you so much for the work that you have done. And thanks for joining us here in the studio today to talk about it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.